This is a previously recorded episode.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
And Mike Brennan.
And this is episode 22. Yes, that's right. We are now one more than legal of the M Squared TechCast. Welcome. And we've got a couple of great guests for you today.
Yes, we do. We have, starting off with Chastity Pratt Dossey, who writes for Bridge Magazine, which is Phil Powers' magazine, well, empire that he built, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago. And they do really great investigative work. And we're going to hear about her story coming out tomorrow, where she looks at the Flint water crisis from the point of view of the folks that are affected and how they now mistrust all levels of government. No one is left out of this. They hate them all. Well, I hate them, but don't trust them, right? And then in the second half hour, we're going to have Betsy Creedon from Wayne State University's Tech Town, and she's going to be talking about the launch of DTX Launch Detroit, a 10-week technology startup accelerator for college students and recent grads. But first, let's go back to Chastity. Welcome.
Hello.
So anyway, let's talk about your story. Now, one of the things that you did, I know you've been working on this for a while because John Bebo, your editor, actually the boss, I guess, mentioned it to me that you've been looking into this for some time. And your point of view on the story that's going to be running tomorrow on Bridge is that people right now just don't trust government at any level because of this crisis, because it seems like what? All levels seem to have been lying to them, or at least that's what they think.
Well, when you go up there and you talk to people, I just went, honestly, on a fishing expedition to find out what's going on, how people were feeling in response to the crisis, response, and et cetera. And it didn't matter where I went or who I talked to. People, all on their own volition, just expressed some distrust for the government. And when I say the government, we're talking local officials, county officials, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, Health and Human Services, EPA, you name it. If there have been officials who have been found to have some role in this, then at this point, people in Flint give them, you know, the total side eye and distrust.
Wow. Okay. So you guys have, Bridge has done a lot of extensive investigations into this. I know, I'm not sure how far back it goes, but I know I've read a lot of your coverage, right?
Well, one of the things that we have done that sets us apart from what you're going to see in the dailies is this extensive timeline. And it's a living, breathing, huge chronological compilation of everything that's happened. If you go to Bridge Magazine, bridgemi.com, and click on the Flint water crisis icon, you'll see the timeline of everything that we thought, you know, people really needed to know about how this crisis unfolded. And it starts with the 2011 appointment of an emergency manager in Flint and goes all the way through until last week. And every week, you know, there's something new that comes out about who knew what and when, and we're adding those new revelations to the timeline as well. It's huge. You know, it's long. There are some points of contextual analysis added. We do the Michigan Troop Squad, so that's an attempt to not only tell people what's important, but what it means. So this timeline says what has happened from the beginning, and there's a little analysis kind of woven throughout. And when I say it's long, it's, you know, thousands of documents that have been, you know, basically synthesized into this. It's like an encyclopedia, like a reference material for anyone who wants to know what happened.
According to what was sent to me, you guys have done more than 30,000 words, crystallizing thousands of pages of documents. And like you say, you have become the reference for what's happening up there in Flint.
Right. I mean, the timeline, I think, is most useful for people if they want to say, oh, wait a minute, what did the MDEQ say about this? Then you can go right to that, to our timeline, and do a search, and it'll take you to what happened in February of, 2014, or it'll take you to, what happened in 2015. It's huge. It's like I said, it's like reference material. I mean, there are some people, of course, who are going to sit down and read, from beginning to end, from top to bottom, but really it's great reference material. We're adding to it, as new information comes out.
And then your story that comes out tomorrow, I imagine it's fairly long, right? How many thousands of words is it?
It's not that many thousands of words. But I think, again, where Bridge is going to stand out differently from the rest of the media on the story is telling people what does it all mean. We're not doing the day-to-day stories, but, we're doing the stories from 30,000 feet, looking across the landscape and really trying to tell people what it all means policy-wise and, impact on people's day-to-day lives. So tomorrow's story is going to say, look, when you step back and look at this, how have people's routines been changed by this? How has their outlook on their life and their government's response been impacted? You have people in Flint who, they wake up every morning and their day is nothing like it was a year ago. They have to use bottled water. They don't trust all of the bottled water that they're getting because of things that have been revealed about recalls. And, that's where we're at with this.
Wow.
You have people who they use water filters. These are free water filters that are given out by all branches of government. But there have been problems with the water filters.
Such as
people don't trust them.
They don't filter out the lead. Then they're not filling out the lead, or exactly what?
Well, there was a story last week that the EPA had to go back in and test different people's water because when you read the labels on these filters, it only filters out a certain amount of lead. If you have an extraordinary amount of lead coming to your home, there's a concern that maybe the filter isn't going to get all of it out. So, revelations like that come out every day, and it really erodes people's trust in government. You told me I could use the filter. Now you're telling me it doesn't filter out everything. That's the kind of mindset that we are seeing amongst people in Flint, right or wrong. They just have doubts now when it comes to, pronouncements about what they should or shouldn't be doing.
I was muted. How about that? Had the cough button on. This is Matt Rausch. Can you give me some kind of, have you measured this over time, what the change has been, or is this the first time you've done this, asked these kinds of questions of the folks in Flint? I was just curious that, like 60% of them used to trust local government, now 30% of them do. Is it that kind of result that you've obtained?
No, it's not. We didn't do a poll or survey or anything scientific of that nature. I visited up there four or five times over the course of 3 weeks in different capacities. Went to fire departments where they are giving out the water cartridges, water filters and cartridges and water, bottled water. I went to a couple of lead testing fairs where people in the community have been bringing their children to get them tested, get their blood tested. And a couple town hall meetings, NAACP meeting, and also what we did do is we looked at this first few rounds of residential water testing, because people are being given this bottle, the sample bottle at the fire department. They get the bottle, they take it home, they fill it up, and then they take it back to the fire department. Their water is essentially tested, and the results are posted online. So I went literally door to door to one neighborhood where there were a lot of high lead levels readings from those results. And
how many houses did you hit? How many houses did you hit, roughly?
I hit 12 homes in one neighborhood.
Okay.
In one afternoon. And you got to remember that these are people who are voluntarily taking their water to get it tested. Everyone's not doing it,
Sure.
there are whole swaths of the city where very, very few people have turned in those samples so far. But this one particular neighborhood I visited, you know, Matt, when they say your water has 15 parts per billion, you know, lead reading, that's not good. that's what they call the action level. So I looked at homes that had an action level. One house had a reading of 5,013 parts per billion.
Oh, my God.
Like, at that point, that's, like, hazardous waste.
Yeah, I was going to say that I remember reading that somewhere, that a couple of the water samples met the technical requirement to be toxic waste.
So. Exactly. So I found that number, and then I looked. Actually, our data guy, Mike Wilkinson, pulled out this neighborhood and said, you know, this is weird. So I went and I knocked on those doors and talked to people about their readings, whether they understood them, what they were going to do about it. And overwhelmingly, the people who I was, you know, people I actually spoke to, they were confused. They were upset that, you know, they had these high readings, but even the document that came in the mail that told them they had the high reading didn't tell them what to do about it. So these types of issues have people really thinking, well, you know, who am I to trust? They send me this paper. It says I have high lead, and they don't tell me what to do about it. I'm, you know, am I supposed to trust this number? Am I supposed to trust the MDEQ, you know, when they were supposed to be making sure that this didn't happen in the first place?
Well, the EPA as well. EPA was, you know, their hands are not clean on this either, right?
I tell you, Mike, the EPA, I spoke to one lady, the EPA came and tested, took a sample themselves from her home and left. And she's like, okay, so what now? They didn't even tell me what they were going to do with the water or what they were going to do in response. It's devastating what's happening to some people, and they don't know what to do about it.
What are you relaying these concerns, or did you relay these concerns to the government officials to get them to react to what people are saying? I'm sure you did, right?
Right. But, you know, it's a situation where you have people who are totally disproportionately affected by this, just railing and railing and railing at the government. And, you know, you call the governor's office and you say, what do you say in response? You know, hey, he's been apologizing. He's been saying, you know, for weeks now that he's working on it. You know, what are they supposed to do? What are they supposed to say? That's the sort of response you get. Well, we're working on it. We're working on it. We're sorry. And then, you know, you go back to Flint, and people have to continue to get on with their lives, and they don't really know how to do that.
Now, what about washing, bathing? Can you do that in this kind of water? Is it, do you absorb through the skin just like if you drink it?
That's another point of confusion amongst the folks in Flint, that, you know, they're told, you know, if you filter the water, you have to filter it while it's cold, and then you can heat it up and drink it or do whatever you want to with it as long as you filter it. But some people, you know, the filter doesn't sit on your bathroom faucet. The filter doesn't sit on your shower head. And, you know, it definitely doesn't filter the water in your washing machine and your dishwasher. So, you know, you have some people not using their dishwasher or washing their clothes, you know, at their cousin's house in Grand Blanc because they don't know what to, you know, what to do. And also there have been reports that if you remember like a couple of weeks ago, that they're going to continue to test, try and figure out why people are getting rashes, because apparently, you know, you've heard the stories. Hundreds and hundreds of people have been complaining since the beginning. This is giving me a rash. Well, that's not supposed to be a reaction to lead. Maybe it's a bacteria. Maybe it's something else. So that is being studied right now. And the people in Flint, you know, what I've been hearing from people in Flint is I don't bathe as often. I use, you know, bottled water and try and, you know, clean myself with that and only take a shower twice, three times a week. It's affecting people's day-to-day lives in ways that they're getting along, but not sure if everything that they're doing is right and everything. They're not sure that everything the government is telling them is wrong.
Well, the city has switched back to the Detroit water system at this point, right?
The city switched back to the Detroit water system.
So the water is
with phosphate.
Yeah, so the water is once again coming from Lake Huron, which is far less corrosive, so fewer chemicals are needed, that kind of thing, and you know, you would think that gradually the Flint River water is being flushed out of the system. Would take a while for it to all be replaced, I would imagine. I mean, I'm not an engineer. I don't know for sure. But, you know, but they're still in a position where they don't trust it, right?
Well, that's because the phosphates that they're treating the water with are supposed to coat the lead pipes and stop the lead from the pipes from leaching into the water. Because you got to remember, Matt, that the problem is that the water was so corrosive that it made the lead pipes essentially sprinkle lead into the water.
Right. The source water from the Flint River wasn't where the lead was coming from. It's coming from old pipes and old solder, right?
Well, it's coming from that water not being properly treated to stop the lead from leaching. Because you got to remember, when they were on Detroit River water, Huron Lake water from the Detroit water system, that water was treated with a proper anti-corrosive. So that water wasn't stripping the lead from the pipes. It's the same pipes.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
It's the same pipes, but the Detroit water didn't strip the lead from the pipes and contaminate the water.
Oh, I know. I mean, I live in an old house in Dearborn. I'm quite certain with the, you know, what appear to be cast iron pipes, and I bet you anything there's lead in the solder there. So, you know, it's just properly treated. It's not a problem.
Right, but that's why it's really important. They're trying to encourage people now to participate in testing their water. They have like 400 families, they being the state, 400 families that are volunteered to be sentinels to have their water tested regularly to see if the pipes are being properly coated and to ensure that this new water is not leaching lead, that the problem is being, you know, mitigated. At the same time, you know, again, I was in the neighborhood where people are still getting lead readings in their water. I think what I find is people are most upset about the fact that they don't know how long they'll have to continue to live like this.
So you going door to door, do they think automatically that you're a government official, or have you run into any kind of problems with that?
Not so far, but, I went to one elderly woman's home and her daughter was there and she did ask me for a card because, you know, her mom was older and she had a problem with her mom opening the door for people and letting them in and it didn't turn out to be who they thought they were supposed to be. So, that only happened once, but, what I tell them, I'm a journalist, that's like good news to them because they do want to tell their story.
So you're wearing one of those fedoras with a press badge in it, right? So they know right away.
Not old press boy's cap, no.
Yeah, there you go, something like that. Hey, the other thing now, I am not up on the story as I should be, but I know there's been mention of something about Legionnaire's disease. Would that be the source of the rashes, or is that something else? Has anyone been able to identify that?
So, yeah, if you go to the timeline on BridgeMI.com, Bridge Magazine, we added that to the timeline just last week, the story that broke over the last week or so about the county officials and the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Health and Human Services going back and forth and back and forth months and months ago about this uptick in Legionnaire's cases and Legionnaire's disease. Is a pneumonia type of disease that you can get by inhaling water vapors. Usually in Genesee County, they have between 6 and 11 or so cases. Well, 2014, 2015, 87 cases and 9 people died. In 2014, in 2015, there were very many internal discussions about this, and Genesee County officials were really up in arms about it. Well, it never really got out that this was, you know, this outbreak was something to be concerned about. And we saw just last month the governor say, look, we got this outbreak going on, 9 people have died. You know, this is a concern. Well, news being what it is, emails, you know, being obtained by different news organizations, it comes out that, you know, county and state officials knew about this and you know, we're going back and forth with the Centers for Disease Control. Again, this is one of those things where people in Flint read about these internal discussions that went on for months and months and months before it became public, and it makes them more concerned that, you know, the government is covering up something. The word cover up were even used in between some of the government officials who are emailing about this. It doesn't do anything but further erode public sentiment and public trust.
I imagine the place is swarming with personal injury lawyers right now, right? I would imagine those people are all over the place.
Absolutely. Figer apparently has a few clients whose family members died of Legionnaires' disease. And again, these cases, some of them were traced to a hospital in the area and definitely suspected to be linked to the water.
So tell us a little bit about you Bridge also did a story on funding cuts to the DEQ as sort of compromising their ability to deal with problems like this. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
That was a story that was done by Ted Roloff, one of our freelancers. And essentially, it's a story about an audit that came out became apparent through some of these emails between county, city, state officials. Again, you got to remember, I mean, you know, Matt and Mike, you guys know this. Over the last few weeks, every news organization in the area has been using a Freedom of Information Act to obtain emails. And then, you know, Friday, the governor gave out more of his emails that, you know, between state and local officials regarding this. Well, in that pile, those thousands of emails and documents, there was mention of this audit. And this audit essentially said, look, this this department, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, has had issues and budget cuts going back years and years and years that essentially have put monitoring of our drinking water at risk. That's the long and short of it. The last few years, you see cuts to personnel, cuts to the MDEQ's ability to monitor water, and what do you think is going to happen? That's what essentially the story is about. And again, this is a story by Ted Roloff in Bridge Magazine.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. I have your bio here in front of me, and you're a former Free Press education writer. So how long have you been a journalist? How many years now?
Oh, since 1995.
Ah, okay. Go back 20 years
now. Most of the time at the Detroit Free Press. So yeah, I'm born and raised in Detroit, from Detroit, educated in Detroit public schools, and went away right after school, did an internship at the New York Times, and after that, I did the Oregonian.
Yes.
For a few years out in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I lived in Seattle for 7 years, so I worked at the Times up there. So I'm very familiar with the Oregonian.
Yep, so that was my first, like, real full-time everyday job. That was very, very different, as you know, from Detroit.
Yes, very much.
Yeah, and then I went out to New York and worked at Newsday for a few years and was actually working there when 9/11 happened. So that was a crazy period in my career. And then after that, shortly after 9/11, came back home to work the Free Press. And did that for most of my career, covering the school.
And you do some regular broadcast radio with WDET, don't you?
Yes. Just a little background on that. You know, Bridge is the convening partner in the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, and essentially what that is nonprofit media organizations in town. You got Bridge Magazine, and Detroit Public TV, Detroit Public Radio, Michigan Public Radio, as well as local ethnic media. We're all part of this cooperative where we're working to cover Detroit post-bankruptcy. Actually, we covered Detroit, the bankruptcy itself, and now we're on post-bankruptcy for the next year. We'll be doing projects about that, all of these media organizations together.
And hopefully the Detroit Public Schools won't go into bankruptcy, right?
Oh, well, I doubt that. I sincerely doubt that's going to happen.
Okay.
The state is tied too intimately into Detroit public, into all schools operating procedures for, it would cost the state itself more in the long run to allow Detroit public schools to go into bankruptcy. So I surely doubt that's going to happen.
Now, I hate to cut this very interesting topic off here, but we're running out of time in this segment. That's Chastity Pratt. Is it pronounced Dossie or Dowsie?
Dossie.
Okay. You're with Bridge Magazine, and for those folks listening or that'll listen to the On Demand, give that URL for Bridge Magazine again.
We're at www.bridgemi.com. So that's Bridge MI as in Michigan.
And
BridgeMI.com.
Yep, Bridge Magazine is a terrific resource here in Michigan, set up by our friend Phil Power, the publishing magnate, and he has become a magnate online as well.
And his right-hand man, John Bebo, an old Detroit News reporter.
Yeah, old booth guy, too. So,
yeah,
yep.
So. All right, well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and this is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch. You're listening to the M Squared TechCast. Stick around. We're going to be right back with another fascinating guest. It's Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan.
And you're listening to the M Squared TechCast, and it's time for our next segment.
Betsy Creedon, Wayne State University Tech Town's Director of Entrepreneurial Services. She's going to be talking about the DTX Launch Detroit program. Welcome, Betsy.
Thank you. Thank you.
So tell us about DTX Launch Detroit. I have the little bio here, but I'd rather come from you than me.
Okay. Well, it's just the most fun thing that I do. It's a summer boot camp for college students with tech-based startup ideas. So we're in at the application phase right now. It's online. We look at all the different applications, come up with maybe 12 to last year. We actually had 16 teams we accepted. And we put them through 10 weeks of real intensive training, and at the end, they have to pitch. So it's a lot of fun.
What's coming out of the sausage machine? What sorts of companies are you getting coming out of the other end of this program?
Under the end of the program. Well, we've been doing this for 3 years, and I'm going to say, let's say we had 36 graduate teams. We've got, we've got a restaurant app. We have a home care, sort of an Uber for home care services that we're actually still working with. We've got a financial program for college students to help them. It's called the Broke App, help them so they don't become broke. We've got a program.
I think that's part of being a college student. You're perpetually broke, right? So, ramen noodles.
It's all sorts of things we've got.
Yeah. Okay, good. And then, so let's talk about it. You got a program, an information program coming up on February 24th.
We do. And because we're attracting college students, we have pizza. It's February 24th at 6 o'clock, and we've done this every year, and it's really a lot of fun. We invite our alums back. They actually are our best salespeople. I also use them when I go to colleges to recruit. I pull them in to help me. So on the 24th, 6 o'clock here at Tech Town, we'll have pizza, a presentation, and then we'll have a number of people talking to the people who come, the applicants who come with their ideas, and talk them through it. And if they need help on their application, we'll help them there too.
How many, for these info sessions, how many typically come? 50, 40, 100?
Yeah, about 50. Yeah, about 50, usually. You know, we usually have about 75 registration, and somewhere between 40 and 50 come.
So how many times have you been through this? How many 10-week programs have you run of this sort?
We've run three. This will be our fourth.
Okay.
And we it changes every year. We learn from our students, which is great. I've done it all 4 years, or will have done it all 4 years, and I learn something every time I do it. I would encourage anyone out there who knows of a student who has an idea, tech-based or tech-enabled, it's not hard to go to our website and check out DTX Launch Detroit at the Tech Town Detroit website. The application is really simple. It's very straightforward. We don't expect rocket science in the beginning, but we do at the end. No. But we really encourage all students to apply.
Well, now that you brought that up, why don't you give that URL out so those folks can rush to type in what that is so they can apply?
Okay. Well, the thing that I would suggest, the best way to do it, is to go to techtowndetroit.org. And you'll see on it, it'll say Programs, Labs, and it'll take you to DTX Launch Detroit, and that'll link you right into the application. I should have the app URL. You're right. I should have that in my brain, and I think it's like I'll look it up right now while we're talking.
Okay. Now, let's get back to, you were saying you've learned something new every year. Give me some examples. What did you learn from year one that you're carrying over into year four?
Year one, we were very strict. We were very regimented. We had our program, and we started it out as our first year, and we wanted to adhere to all the scheduling. And what we realized is that you really have to take into account the personality of the cohort. The students are different every year. The way they interact with each other is different every year, and we have to be flexible as presenters. Doesn't mean we lower quality or standards or anything, but things come up to take advantage of. Just like any startup, you've got to be very open to, a student may come in with an idea that's a little different and needs a different kind of support, and so you bring that support in. So we've really opened ourselves up a little bit to the input from the students year to year to year in order to really react to what is best for them, but it's different every year. One year we had mostly apps. You know, students love apps, and so we had to really tailor a lot of our subject matter experts into the IT software world, where the year before that we didn't have as many apps, and so we didn't have to have as many specific lessons, let's say, on the software startup area. So that's the kind of thing we learn. And we've really been lucky, too. The last 2 years we've had two teams from Duke University that come to Detroit, students that come to Detroit, and they've been working with our students to help market the program for us. So, and they work with our students, and students won't say to us what they'll say to other students. So that's another way we've learned how to react to what they need.
So can you give me an example or two of some of the companies that have come to you through this program?
Sure. Well, we have two now that actually won awards in the last 2 years and are now incubating in Tech Town, which is taking them to the next step. One is called CARE PRN, and they came to us through the first, I'm going to say this right, I know, Health Hacking Health Hackathon, which we did last year here at Tech Town. And this was a student group of nurses and healthcare providers that have a program that they're designing, and it's the one I talked about a little bit earlier. It's kind of an Uber for home care. So, for example, I have I care for my mother at home, and I get a call in the morning that I need to be somewhere that afternoon. This is a service that I can call right away, get somebody right away along the Uber model that is completely vetted and that I've registered with the program, so I know that they have someone that can care for my mom or stay with my mom so I can be free to go somewhere else. So that's CARE PRN. And then, excuse me, Evolve is a really interesting company. Three students, two were seniors, I think one was a grad student. All three were counselors, part-time counselors in Detroit Public School, different schools. And they came together and they determined that, you know, I don't know if my numbers are right, so I'm don't hold me to it, but pretty much in a high school, a counselor's got 300 to 400 students that they have to deal with per person. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of opportunities for these students are missed because a counselor can't know everything for 300 kids. And so they have put together a program called ProUp, which will gather all the information, let's say in the Detroit area right now, let's say about summer internships and scholarships and work programs that would be of interest to students and to guidance counselors. So it's for use with parents, students, and guidance counselors. And it can be targeted for the student's interest. So if you have a student who's really good in math and wants to do something that way, then the offerings will be more targeted to that student's interests. And they're getting a lot of play. Both of these teams won student prize money at the Accelerate Michigan in December. They both won student awards in that competition. So that's three. We have one team that's working with the Detroit Water Department on a way to help monitor for the homeowner their water usage. So that's a totally different kind of thing. So those are the kinds of programs that have come out of Tech Town. But our main goal, although ideally, would be to create companies, and that's certainly our goal with our Accelerate program and our incubation program. With the students, we have it's just as important for the students to really grasp the fundamentals of startup business. And if their idea doesn't succeed, we want them to have the skills because they're going to have another idea, and we want that idea to succeed. So it's a little different emphasis than a normal accelerator program would be in an accelerator or incubator in the tech world. One of the things that they learn that it's just phenomenal is how to pitch. So we have them come in the first day and they pitch their idea, and then at the last day when we have the pitch contest for the public, you just can't believe how they have progressed in their skills. It's really exciting. And we all know that no matter what we do in life, we have to pitch, whether we're fundraising for our church or we're an engineer that wants to pitch a program within an auto company or you're a startup. So those kinds of skills are really important to us that the students come away with.
So of the 30 kids that you've had come through in the summer, you talked about three. Now, those three, are they the only examples of very successful programs, or excuse me, pitches or projects that went on then to get into your accelerator or went on to get funding? Have there been other examples?
Most of them don't go on. Most of them find out that their idea isn't really what they thought it was. And as we say fail fast. That's a positive outcome. We did have another company whose name is going to come to me, My Fab Five out of
Ann Arbor. I've heard of those folks.
Yep. It's a restaurant app, but they do a lot more than that. It's a marketing app for business, and they've been very successful. They were one of our companies. But you know, another example was a company that we had the first year, Startify, and by the end of the 10 weeks, their team had kind of fallen apart. I mean, it wasn't working. The idea wasn't working. Their customer discovery was telling them that no one really wanted their product. And so we had our final pitch, and they didn't want to pitch because they really didn't have a company.
Yeah, that would be important.
Well, here's the thing that's really cool. The leader of that team got up publicly and talked about the process and talked about why their business, you know, why their idea didn't work and what they had gotten out of the program. And he was amazing. Now I'm still in touch with him. He's a graduate student at U of M in biotechnology, and he wants to start his own biotechnology lab when he finishes graduating. So here's a case where they learned their idea wasn't good, but they learned the skills. They had the courage. I mean, they were amazing. When he got up and spoke, it was really fabulous. They had the courage to kind of share that with people. But the skills are there, and now Scott is, you know, he's pursuing his master's so that he can start his own lab company. So that's a good example of sort of a different outcome.
What would be, I mean, number one, this is open to students. They don't have to be going to Wayne State or anything, right?
Oh, no. We've had 10 different colleges in our program. So oh. We love that. And we love mixing up the students, and they love me. They create lifelong friends, too. That's another thing that's very cool.
And the end game isn't to get them into the accelerator. It's to get them thinking about what it's really like to be an entrepreneur, right?
Correct.
Yeah, because I mean,
another great example is two young men from the University of Detroit Mercy. One of them, an engineer, their team, again, they had a great idea called Soup Spoon, but they just couldn't get it. The competition was already heavily established, and so they decided they weren't going to continue with that. It was a spoon to help people, say, who have Parkinson's and stuff, be able to eat better and more easily. And so one of those students, because he's hanging out in Decktown, has joined another startup business here at Decktown, not from the program. And now he's in a new startup supporting another businessman who is got a startup here. You probably heard about it. Identilock, Sentinel, it's a gun lock. Omer's gotten a lot of
The biotech feedback thing? Is it biotech? It's like read
yep.
your signature,
yep.
your fingerprints or something, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So now there's a case where the student networked what he learned with another startup and he's doing startup, but it's with a different startup.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
yeah.
That's the funny thing about entrepreneurship. You just never know where it's going to go once you start meeting people and plugging in. But
exactly.
The point being is, I mean, the most successful entrepreneurs are the ones that identify a problem and then come up with a way to fix the pain. I mean, that's really what business
exactly.
is about, right? You know?
Exactly. And that's really, you asked about changing, how we've changed over the 3 years. When we first started, when I told you we had a more disciplined, that's sort of not a good word, but a more regimented curriculum, we were teaching the business model canvas, which is an excellent way to visualize all the aspects of a business. And we adhered to that pretty tightly. It's a great discipline. It's part of the lean startup philosophy, and it works really well. Well, what we've discovered is that these really, really early stage students, just to pick up exactly where what you just said, customer discovery and value prop, they have to hammer that in. So this year, we will, of course, expose them to the business model canvas because it's an excellent, excellent tool. But we are really going to spend a lot more time on exactly what you said, customer discovery. You know, what is the pain and then how do we solve it? Because we think we know the pain, but until we talk to our customers, we don't. You're absolutely right.
You were saying that a couple of these companies, student projects, got Accelerate Michigan funding.
Mm-hmm.
Have
yep.
any of them gone on beyond that and gotten, say, angel funding or anything like that?
One of them is really close to angel funding. They have gotten other funds, and they are especially Evolve, the pro-op company that I told you about, the counseling program. They've won a number of awards, and I can't give them to you now, but they were flown to Washington, D.C. They pitched there and received an award there. They do a lot of this competitive pitching. They're not quite ready yet for angel funding, but that's why we're working with them. That's why they're in our incubation program, to get them ready for that.
I'm particularly intrigued by that Uber program for yeah. older folks, because I was the caregiver for my parents until they passed,
yep.
and
yep.
you're trying to be as accommodating as you can with their schedule. At the same time, you got to make a living and have a life, right?
Right.
And
exactly.
So, go into a little bit more detail on that. I'm really curious to know how that works. Now, you say, because for instance, do they just pick them up in a car like Uber, or is it a special?
No. They would go to your home. So, let's just use the example I had. So, I'm the caregiver for my mother. And she's living with me in my home, and I have a regular routine, and we probably have regular people coming in on a regular basis to support what I'm doing. And then something comes up, either I get sick, or maybe an opportunity for me. Somebody calls and says, "Hey, I got tickets to the theater tonight. You want to go?" And it's not in my regular scheme of things. What do I do? How do I make sure my mom is taken care of, and I have the freedom to react to something? That's where this comes in. And so when I say Uber, it's the idea of the instantaneous response that Uber has. You don't plan it ahead of time. So they would have vetted a number of providers who buy into being providers under this system, just like an Uber driver would. And they will know their skills and what they need. And I, as a caregiver, will have registered with this program, so they'll know about my mom and about me. And so I'll call up and say, "Hey, you know, I know it's noon, but I really need someone by 6 o'clock. It's for 4 hours, yada yada," and they'll find someone for me. It's that kind of program.
And if, say, your parent or whatever that you're caring for, you're out on the town, something happens, do these people then would take them to the hospital, or?
Oh, sure, they would be. They're going to be fully registered and vetted. And again, I'm talking like I'm not part of that company, so their spokesman, I'm sure, he would love to talk to you guys if you're more interested in it, far more articulate than I am. But what's so cool is the leader of the pack, Jason, came to Hacking Health Hackathon here, which I think I mentioned we did it with the University of Windsor, and we had this full weekend, and he met his team members here. He had the idea. And others came to wanting to be in a health care kind of business. And they're still with that. They're together. So he's from Oakland University. He's getting his master's. He's got someone from, he's got two people from U of M, and I think one from Wayne State. They met at the hackathon. They became a team. It's a great team. They won the hackathon, and as a result, they won being in DTX Launch Detroit because they're students. They were in our DTX program last year, and because they were so good, they won now incubation here at Tech Town. Plus, they're one of the teams that won at Accelerate Michigan, and they've won a couple of other things too. So that's a very interesting progression of how you bring people together, ideas together, things hit, it works, and they continue on. And it's just, that's what's fun about being here at Tech Town and being in the ecosystem that we have going in this part of the country. It's really fun. You like to see those sparks fly.
Yeah, and Tech Town is a Wayne State enterprise, but this is by no means restricted to Wayne State students.
Oh, not at all. Yep.
You got students from all over the place, it sounds like.
We've had students. In fact, we even had 2 years ago a student team from Florida Southern. Now, how could we do that? Because this is supposed to be for Michigan teams. Well, these were kids that were from Detroit who went to Florida Southern but were home for the summer and had an idea. And the deal is that if you make it, if your idea gets through and you're going to make it, that you commit to creating that business here in the Detroit area, which they all were happy to do because this was home for them. So we actually had a team from Florida Southern University, Florida State University, but they were all Detroit kids who had gone there to school together.
Interesting. Let's go back over the details one more time. There may be people tuning in a little late here. DTX Launch Detroit, that you're going to have an information session on February 24th from 6 to 8 p.m.
Which I believe is that a Tuesday or?
It's a Tuesday or Wednesday. Middle of the week.
Middle of the week, yep.
The 24th, that is a Wednesday. Wednesday, 24th.
I don't have a calendar right in front of me, where were we? Okay. 6 to 8 p.m. at Tech Town. I know you're on Burroughs, right?
We are 440 Burroughs. We're between Cass and 2nd. And we have a very large parking lot on Milwaukee between Woodward and Cass. So there's lots of parking. We're going to have pizza. You can register on our website. We use Eventbrite, and to sign up, there's no cost, but we do want to know who's coming. And then our applications are open now for the program itself, and I do have the URL. It's dtx-launch-app.techtowndetroit.org. And you can go on that website. The application's there. Again, there's no fee. It's very self-explanatory. It's not a big secret. The fun thing is we do require up to 3-minute video. And the video, it can be a selfie video. We're not looking for great production value, but we are looking to just get a sense of the team. It really will make a difference. How you talk about with each other on the video, you can kind of see some chemistry sometimes, which is very cool. So applications are open. They close April 22nd.
Yeah, that was my next
question. The program starts in May.
Okay.
So the 10 weeks starts in May.
It starts May 24th is our orientation. So it's after school is out.
Uh-huh.
And another cool thing about this: two of our students, both in master's program. One of UAD Mercy and one from the School of Information at Michigan, got credit for their master's program for a paid, I forgot to mention the money, I should do that, for a paid internship. So each student who's accepted into the program gets a $2,500 stipend thanks to MEDC, NEI, and Bank of America. Those are our wonderful sponsors. Up to three a team, so $7,500 a team max. If there's four on the team, then they got to divide it by four. But they do get paid because we expect them to be working full time for 10 weeks. That was an important thing. I didn't almost forgot to say.
Yes, yes.
I mean,
this and money and the fact that it's over the summer as well. Yeah. This could be like what I did on my summer vacation type thing.
Exactly. And as I said, for the University of Michigan School of Information and for U of D Mercy, both of these were master's students, and part of their requirement was to do a paid summer internship. And they'll submit, a student will submit for it, and I have to fill out a very long form. It's sort of retaliation for me making them apply, I guess. But they did, we had two students that did receive credit, which was wonderful. We get great support from the colleges, great support.
So let's talk a little bit more about Tech Town. Now, I know you may find it hard to believe, but there may be people out there that are not familiar with Tech Town. Although I know it's been around for, 10 or 12 years now, right?
Yep. I think I've only been here 4 years, so I haven't been around the 10. But, I think it's been 10 or 12 years. Well, Tech Town is an incubator and accelerator. We work with... there's three legs to the stool. The one leg is we are building, and so we're real estate, and we have a wonderful working space that you just got to come and see it to believe it. It's open and funky, and it's where a lot of small businesses rent one or two desks, and they meet each other, and they support each other. That's how our young Patrick met Adenalock, the gun lock. So that's our building. And then we have programs called Labs and Blocks. Labs is the one that we've been talking about most, which is our tech-based program. And Blocks, which is very unusual for accelerators, because most accelerators are really more in the tech area. Blocks recognizes the fact that in order for Detroit to succeed, the neighborhoods have to succeed. It's not about downtown and midtown only. And so our Blocks program works in the neighborhoods. We're in seven neighborhoods, and if you ask me to name all seven of them, I will leave out one or two. But we're in seven neighborhoods. We work with the neighborhood development organizations and the shop owners or the service providers to help these programs, these businesses, get on their feet, stay on their feet, grow. And it's a very exciting program. We have portfolio managers in each of the seven areas that we're concentrating on now. And that program also runs, I think, twice a year, maybe three times a year, a retail, what we call retail boot camp, not unlike our 10-week program, because basically it's a startup, only it is totally geared for bricks and mortar retail merchants. And we've got a number of success stories there. It's not the area that I work in most, but the whole Fashion Avenue area, there's like three or four businesses there that have been through our retail boot camp. There's coffee shops all over town. So we're in Brightmoor, Osborne, the Jefferson Corridor, around Hopeville, the University District, I knew I wouldn't forget me, Grandmont, Rosedale, and Southwest Detroit. Those are the seven areas. So we really are an economic development organization that's looking to help startups in the various areas to help Detroit.
We're going to have to leave it at that. We're running out of time. Betsy Creedon, Wayne State University Tech Town Director of Entrepreneurial Services, talking about the DTX Launch Detroit service. It's more than a service. Sure. But anyway, you're going to have your seminar or your session on February 24th if you want to learn more about it. This is Mike Brennan.
And it's Matt Rausch, and you've been listening to the M Squared TechCast. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m. If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.
This is a previously recorded episode.